Right, thank you all for turning up this afternoon. Is there one more? Right. To the talk, Socialism and Sudoku. Or, as I actually realised this morning, I should rename it Socialism, Sudoku and Battenberg. And I wonder if I'd have included that word in the actual title, the draw might have been a bit higher. But thank you all of you who've braved the freezing summer weather to make it here to head office for this scintillating talk, which is about half as interesting as the actual title. So we'll see how this goes. So this is actually the second half of a previous talk. So this is a direct continuation of the talk I gave a couple of years ago on the Incas. And it's on the same subject, whereas that wasn't about the Incas neither. It's all about economic calculation and how we can operate in socialism. And so this takes off more or less where that left off, which was a description of how a society had been organised, a complex economy that organised itself without using money, and to now look at some of the ways in which we can answer the economic calculation problem and say we can have socialism. At the outset, I have to say that I am not an expert in mathematics or in public choice theory or in game theory, so all I can suggest that, say that I am, is someone who's averagely educated with access to a decent library and the internet, and who's read around a few bits. So if anyone out there listening on the recording is a mathematician or a genius and thinks that I'm talking absolute nonsense, well, all I can say is that I've gathered what I have from public sources, none of which are seen screaming, this is all nonsense and completely wrong. So what I'm going to do very briefly is talk about Sudoku. That's only going to be a little part of the front. But the point about Sudoku is it's a very good example of the sort of problem or illustration of the sort of problems that we are going to have in planning and organising a society without money. And I hope it helps to crystallise some of the things that, when we have this discussion, seem fairly nebulous to a lot of people, and to show how quite concrete and difficult the problems are that we're going to have to overcome. And then I'm going to discuss various, well, you call them mathematicians, but thinkers in the 20th century in practice who have come up with what I would say is ideas that we could say resolve these problems and that can be used and indicate a wider way forward. And in particular, how these ideas that they've had have come out of actual practice, and although we're no fans of the various state capitalist regimes that have occurred in the 20th century, part of what their experience is, it has thrown up some useful intellectual evidence and experience that we can use going onwards. And finally, I'm going to end up suggesting that fundamentally it all comes back down to politics, administration, and people and democracy. And that's the important bit. And so we don't need to be mathematical geniuses or to understand complex mathematical problems, because at the end of the day, democracy is something we can understand and we can use for ourselves. I've been having a bit of a William Morris weekend. I was up at Kelmscott Manor yesterday, which is a very attractive place to go. And having flicked through my books and things, found yet again that he's on the money. This is from what chapter number is it? News from Nowhere. Well, the pages won't turn. It doesn't help if you've got a 19th. So this is the last paragraph of chapter 12. "You are right, neighbour," said he, "although there are so many of us, indeed by far the greater number amongst us, who would be unhappy if they were not engaged in actually making things, and things which turn out beautiful under their hands, there are many, like the housekeepers I was speaking of, whose delight is in administration and organisation, to use long-tailed words. I mean people who like keeping things together, avoiding waste, seeing that nothing sticks fast uselessly. Such people are thoroughly happy in their business, all the more as they are dealing with actual facts and not merely passing counters round to see what share they shall have in the privileged taxation of useful people, which was the business of commercial folk in past days." And I think that's... I was deliberating whether or not to use that as the opening or the closing of this talk, because that's where we're at, which is that we don't have to understand. All we have to hope is that there will be people understand. But at a propagandistic point, obviously, when you're talking to people, everyone sort of like says, oh, markets, I understand them. Supply and demand. Prices, you understand where you're at. Now, actually, markets are much more complicated than supply and demand. And the vast majority of people actually trying to read an economics textbook would be lost within a few words. But the fact is that it's lodged in the people's minds through their daily experience that operating markets is something that they understand and is actually very simple. And so we need to be slightly aware of that in saying that we do have answers for how we can go about organising a future society. Now, almost another fantastic example of the way these things go, I needed to blow this up and get another size again, but unfortunately I've turned up on a day when the photocopy is broken. So you're going to have to put up with the fact that this is, oh, it's going to sound really terrible on the recording, a Sudoku. And I'm sure many of you have seen it in your newspapers and in puzzle books, and it's phenomenally popular and a great pastime. I thoroughly enjoy it, and this talk came out of a Sudoku I was doing a couple of years ago when I got to the very end. I had one cell left to fill, and I found out I'd gone wrong, and I had to go, and I thought there's no way, I'd have to go back to the very start and do it all over again. So just to very briefly describe Sudoku for those who don't know, it is a square that is 9 cells by 9 cells in dimensions. Those cells are divided into 9 sectors, each comprising 3 cells by 3. The aim is to fill every cell with the digits 1 through 9, so that the digits 1 through 9 recur only once in every sector, column and row. And it's remarkably simple. And normally you're given a starting number, and apparently, looking up today, they can't start with less than 17, fewer than 17 populated cells, and it doesn't work. So that's your starting. I know, of course, they come in varying degrees of difficulty based upon how many numbers they supply and the actual spread of where they occur in the grid. And you have to hopefully appreciate how I managed to do the description of Sudoku without saying the word square about 100 times. And this is the one that I threw together as an example. And the chief think characteristic about it is I have gone wrong. And if you look at this cell here, or I think it's this one here, according to the rules, they have to be 8s. But unfortunately, this one, certainly up here, can't be an 8, because there's an 8 in that column there, but there's also 8s there and there that mean it has to be there. So that tells me I've gone wrong. Now, you'll see that I've circled the numbers 5, so that actually I've got all 9 5s on the board. This one is the one I deliberately put in the wrong place. So what this illustrates, this is the point of this to illustrate, is that in this system, even though it's the 5 that's wrong, it's the 8 that appears to be out of order. And it's turned up, and this, if you think about it, how many numbers have gone wrong? Because that was actually the first one I put in. So pretty much every number I put in after that is likely to be incorrect, or certainly most of the 5s, and clearly a lot of the 8s are in the wrong place as well. Now, Sudoku is not a mathematical problem as such. It's clearly a logic problem. You know, you could replace those numbers 1 through 9 with any 9 discrete symbols, as long as they conform with the rules. And it is an example of more or less what you could call a problem in 3 dimensions, because each of those numbers has to satisfy 3 different rules in order to find its way into its own place. And as mathematicians describe, when you had the various planning techniques that they had in the Soviet Union, that was trying to plan in each individual product would represent a dimension in a formula. So to have a commodity that takes up 3 has 3 components, that would require 3 dimensions to solve that problem. And the important thing about them is that it's not the numbers, the absolute numbers of things that you have to have, it's the ratio. So if you have something that's made of 1 part metal, 2 parts wood, it doesn't matter if you've got 100 wood or 100 metal, as long as you have 1 to 2, it's the ratios that you need to keep going together. And it's those supplies and the maintenance of those ratios that mean that you can have the products of your society. And otherwise, you can end up like this grid, which is that I've merrily gone along, and if you can imagine it, the five producers are turning around and saying, well, look, we've fulfilled our quota. We've produced all the fives we need to produce. The problem isn't us. And the eights are turning around and going, well, we're doing what we're supposed to do. We've produced all our eights. Clearly, it's gone wrong somewhere else. And then you've got all these empty squares, which is underproduction, essentially. So we've got a bottleneck and we've got underproduction. So we've got the twin evils of a planned economy. And, of course, there is no way of knowing which numbers on that board are actually wrong, short of going back and looking and starting again. Now, this is a fact about Sudoku, is that it is only amenable, really, to brute force solutions. So you can get a computer that can resolve Sudokus, and they can do it fairly quickly, because it's a 3x3 sector grid. It's fairly amenable. But if you start to expand that out into 4x4 sectors or 5x5, the computational time starts to become far too immense, and it becomes impossible to resolve through computation. And what that basically means is that there is no, Adam's apparently going to talk on algorithmic socialism, there is no formula, there is no algorithm that can help you plan a Sudoku. It is purely by trial and error and the relative positions of the components based upon the information that you have at the beginning of the problem. And I think this does serve as a very useful way of thinking about the economic calculation problem, because it's not about stocks, it's not about inventories, it's not about how many we have of a given thing, or of thinking about how many we want to produce of something. The whole point is that the only way you can it is a problem that can only be resolved through trial and error, through at the firm level, people looking and coordinating between the various different sectors, because each cell has to be resolved in its own right. You can't resolve it based upon the grid as a whole, or before you've populated the grid, or even you can't resolve it through the starting grid. So it's almost like our good friend supply and demand. And of course, what our opponents, and particularly the followers of von Mises, say is that realistically, the only way in which, this is their claim, the only way you can avoid this problem is through exchange. If you have the medium of exchange of commodities, then you will have all of these independent economic actors who would be like ourselves in the grid, producing what is required for the economy. And that's the only way you can relate back to the means of production based upon what you have trying to produce and the demand you're trying to fulfil. And as I think I said in the talk about the Incas, I think that the big problem there is that they're going wrong with the necessity for exchange. What needs to exchange is information. It doesn't have to be commodities, it doesn't have to be circulating and bringing them back. As long as, and this is the point, we have to accept that the economic actors can't... Come on in. Do you want to come in? Or are you just looking through the window? So long as the economic actors can work independently, can coordinate themselves, you don't have a central plan demanding that everyone acts in a certain way. And I think we have to take that on board, that they are right up to that extent, but that they're not right in the requirement for actual physical exchange of commodities. What you need is, I suggest, relative freedom at the firm level. So that's that much. So what we need to have, for our own sake, is the idea that there are mechanisms which will be available to people acting at the firm level within productive agencies, within communities, and within society as a whole, for them to try and coordinate to meet the ends of our common plan for socialism. And I believe that I can take you through several such possibilities that have arisen over the 20th century. So anyone who's seen me writing online will see that I've picked up this name, Leonid Kantorovich, who was a Soviet mathematician who wrote about the allocation of economic resources. I've managed to pick up a copy of the book. Now, it's well beyond me, the mathematics I don't really give it a try, but you know, apparently these days it's quite simple to do with computers. He was actually involved in the siege of Leningrad, and some of the ideas for this mathematics came from him, partly when he was running a plywood firm, and partly through having to administer the rationing in Leningrad. So this is an example of someone who's a mathematical genius having to run into intractable real-world problems that he had to resolve, and that came up with this idea of linear optimization. And interestingly, it's one of these fascinating things about that you find in the history of mathematics, that around about the same time, in the United States, a fellow called George Danzig came up with roughly similar linear equations for resolving similar sort of transportation allocation problems when he was working in airports. So clearly, I mean, obviously they both read the same international papers and come up with similar solutions. Now, for Kantarovich, what he came up with was what in the official documents that eventually got published got called objectively determined valuations, but which Danzig called shadow prices, but which were, in effect, the capacity to look at various different production techniques and derive a system number, or what you could call a pseudo price, for them, so that you could say, well, between this production method and this production method, we will fulfil the demand upon us here. So what this was him trying to show that they could come up with other ways to meet the demands of the economic plan that was operative in the Soviet Union at that time. So this might not sound very much of interest to us, but the key part of the economic calculation problem isn't deciding what we want to ask to have supplied, it's matching supply to the productive method. And what they said was, well, you could decide, von Mises said, well, you could decide whether or not you want to have 2,000 hectolitres of wine or 3,000 hectolitres of wine. The problem is, how do you decide to go about producing that wine? And of course, this method has the possibility of doing that, because he showed that you can at least apply this. Now, he was trying to apply it to a national framework and within a national planning system. And in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, he listed various problems, which included, you know, it was all very well in theory and in the model, but in practice, it didn't work at the firm level, and that there was no incentive at the firm level to supply information back up to the central planners, and all sorts of these things. But the useful thing for us is that, well, there's no reason why it has to be used, I would suggest, as part of an entire global planning process. It could just be used in one individual cooperative factory, whichever, just to decide, well, okay, we need to do this sort of output. We need to choose between production methods. Which one produces the right, we could call it price, we can call it value or system token. It doesn't matter. I mean, as long as we're clear that in socialism there wouldn't necessarily need to be a price or a payment made to exchange, you can still go, well, that one is cheaper to do. That one produces a lower number of a quantifiable value. And it's a possible viable solution. And of course, what it also means is that we have a starting point that other people can work on. Now, if you look in the various literature, this does turn up in critiques, because people say, well, yes, that system works, but the computing power to plan an entire economy using that method just doesn't exist. And even nowadays, with modern computers, we still probably would not be able to use computers to resolve in the way Kantarovich had in mind and plan an entire economy. But it doesn't mean that the tool isn't there to use this to make changes and to plan and to relate the economic outcomes we want to our production choices. Similarly, we have the Nobel Prize in 2012 was given to two people, Lloyd Shapley and Alvin Roth, for their work in something called repugnance economics. Now, these are two fellows who are still alive in the United States, and Alvin Roth is still active and apparently involved in school place allocation in New York, which directly relates to the techniques that they were using. Lloyd Shapley along with some of the guys, I haven't got his first name, Gail, came up with something called the stable matching algorithm. And normally in the maths literature, it's known as, you know, the idea is pairing couples up, boy and girl, together so that both partners are happy. This is a mathematical problem, not a real world application, but the idea is fairly simple. In that what they ask people, what the system asks to be done, is that each party ranks the others in order of preference. And this is a fairly simple process that we could explain into the general world. You'd rank things in order of preference, one, first, second, third, fourth. And they actually do this for things like placements for new doctors. Because you don't want a market to decide where your new doctors go. You want them to go where they're best suited. So on the one hand, you have the hospitals rank the available new doctors in order of preference. The doctors rank the hospitals in order of preference. And what should happen is, through the operation of the algorithm, everyone should get more or less the best choice that's available to them. They might not get their first choice, but they will get their best available choice and should be happy with each other. And it's a fairly simple process, and it is scalable to other things, such as public schools, because obviously just simply saying, well, you know, we've seen in this country, the problem is if you just say within the catchment area, well, parents will move house to get a better catchment area for a better school, if necessary, and it drives up the prices, and it drives the poorer parents out. But if you want people to have some sort of choice, well, you need to make sure that it's not just the most active, determined parents who get to choose the best schools. So you need to have something on the other side. And I've said online, and I still think that this is a sounds like a viable option for allocation of housing, social housing, which could well be used in socialism for things like homes, where you have a relatively small number of goods available, and you know you will have plenty of applicants. And it should provide with a suitable means of replacing the market as a way of allocating these sorts of goods. But obviously the problem that springs to mind straight away, why it's not applicable to absolutely everything, or I think it actually could be quite widely used, is who decides what goods are on the market and who decides who gets to bid in this market. And these are sort of these gateway choices are concerned. Obviously, you don't want to be choosing between 10,000 on one side and 10,000 on another, because again, we get down to hugely complex computational problems that would be irresolvable. But it's certainly, again, not talking about planning across the entire economy, but at the firm level, at the individual local authority, the local street, or whatever. These are tools that could certainly be used, and they could also be used, I suppose, in industry. You know, who gets the printing press? Which firm needs it? Where should it go next? And these sort of questions. So that's another option. And I think the point is, I'm not saying that these things need to be written into the Socialist Manifesto or into wonderful pamphlets like Socialism as a Practical Alternative. There's a new print run over there. If anyone wants to buy it, well worth a read. Who says socialists can't do advertising? But that we can just point the way and say, well, look, there are options available and it can be done. And it just chips away that this doorstop that our opponents will try to use, which is say it's impossible. And we keep on going. Battenberg. I thought I'd drag this in. Apparently, mathematicians are obsessed with slicing cakes. And how to slice a cake fairly. Now, we were taught when we were 5 years old how you slice a cake between two people. It's dead easy. One cuts the cake, the other gets the first choice. It gets more complicated after that. But that's what the mathematicians are trying to resolve. And the Battenberg, I think, is a great example. Does anyone here not like marzipan? Right, so if I was going to cut this cake between me and Danny there, and I drilled a hole of exactly 50% of the volume of the cake down the middle so that none of it contained marzipan, and then gave Danny the choice, because I like marzipan, you see. So Danny would choose the non-marzipan part and I'd get all the marzipan. So that's the sort of sneaky thinking that you get from mathematicians. How do you divide fairly And of course, this apparently has been solved. And of course, I did specify that that was a way of choosing between two people. I mean, it could be that I like the pink bit as well. So I could cut carefully around the pink bits, make sure I don't leave any marzipan, because I don't like marzipan now. Don't like the marzipan, but I don't like the yellow bits neither. I could just get all the pink bits for myself if I wanted by cutting it. And of course, if you have more than two participants, if I cut it unevenly, then the first person to choose will get the biggest bit. And then the last person to choose, me, gets the smallest, and it becomes unfair. So they're very concerned, they are looking into this in great depth. And a couple of people, Brams and Taylor, have found a solution, an algorithm, for fairly cutting up a cake for any number of people. But of course you would find that you would be cutting the cake up into thousands and thousands of pieces in order to share a cake out properly. But this is obviously a mathematical, logical solution for dividing a cake up fairly, so that everyone has an equal envy-free, and they have all sorts of funny definitions of what an envy-free cake slice is. But they have done it. But they've also, as a consequence of this procedure, come up with something called the adjusted winner system, or it's a type of auction. And this is much more interesting than cake dividing, I think, because what happens in the adjusted winner auction is, and apparently it's very useful in divorce settlements. You can use it in divorce settlements, and it runs something like this: you give each participant 100 points to divide between the contents of the house, and they'll pick out the things that matter to them most. And then once you've sort of like done that, you then go through and start juggling the points through the system. They've got a computer algorithm that does this, so that they will get the best share of the things in the house matching their choices. And as near to an actual choice as can be managed. And now this only works, as clearly someone has spotted this potential on the Wikipedia article, because they've gone in and said, yes, but this doesn't work when you have homogeneous goods subject to marginal utility, by which they mean, you know, if you had lots of oil, you couldn't then have an adjusted winner auction for oil, because it's all the same stuff. But they do have a different system for dividing homogeneous goods out. But of course, this comes back to a similar problem of I think this sounds like it could be very useful for, you know, communities, local authorities, or even, you know, at a sort of like intermediate stage, you know, trying to get hold of washing machines to put in their local stores, this sort of thing. It comes down to, again, who gets to enter into this market? How do you get in to have your 100 points to divide around? And what gets put into this market? But I do think that there seems to me that you could solve the problem of homogeneous goods by saying, well, okay, well, we'll divide the oil up into parcels of varying sizes, and people can bid for 100 litres versus 10 litres. So it seems to me that there is this option for using this system at a fairly rather large regional level. And so the last name that's going to come up on my fairly brief tour, because I think any one of these systems and ideas, I'm sure you can gather, could probably have taken an entire lecture in itself, is a guy called Stafford Beer, who was the cyberneticist. And he worked trying to computerise industry and systematise it. Now this is coming back up to a much more global level, because I've been talking a lot about, you know, how can we make sure that we can do this at the firm level, so that individual economic actors can relate without having to work according to a global top-down plan. But I'll come back to how he is relevant in a second. But what he's relatively famous for is something called Project Cybersign, which was an attempt to cyberneticise the Chilean economy under Salvador Allende. As I'm sure you can gather, it didn't work. This is 1973 in Chile. What it amounted to was fixing a fax line or a telephone line to the factory, and having a central control room. And apparently, as an example of the sort of this is the great problem with utopian top-down design plans. He had this Star Trek-like control room where they had keyboard with big keys, because he imagined big burly workers with their big thumping hands being unable to do the little delicate typing work with little keyboards. And of course, it was wildly unpopular, and it didn't work partly because, to say the least, there was no buy-in from the people around. You know, this was an attempt from the very top to create this system, almost by presidential fiat. Apparently, when presented with the plan, Allende listened carefully to what the description, and then when it was pointed out that that's the bit where the president, he got went, "Ah, the people," and seemed very pleased with himself at that point. So I think that's kind of an illustration of the very deeply flawed mindset. So we're not interested in it for that, except obviously that someone did a try to set up a networked production plan within one country. And it does produce some very interesting ideas. Now, you've seen me looking at the wall. That's the best. I was sure I could find different charts of that. But that's Stafford Beer's Viable Systems Model Subsystems. And he has five stages of a viable system. And system one, the thing that does the work, the actual factory, the workshop, the subsectors. System two, hang on. So system two resolves conflicts between the system one subsectors, and then you've got system three, which is monitoring the whole process. System four looks outside to immediate threats, and system five just monitors that everything is going correctly and is more or less the brain. And I've seen another chart that makes it look like an insect, because clearly he was almost considering, you know, the insect nervous system is your almost one of your most basic viable systems. They're fairly, on the one hand, quite complex, but on the other hand, a very basic system that survived and is incredibly robust. And just to give you a bit of an idea of what we're talking about, so if you think about that, the Socialist Party, the level one systems would be the branches. And then the branch officers would be system two, and maybe the committees and departments, as they interrelate between the branches carrying out the activity. System three would be the EC. And then system four would be conference, and system five would be the membership as a whole. So the important point is that these systems are recursive. So the idea is that every level, so within a branch, you'll still have these five system layers as part of your ongoing process for doing a particular activity. And the reason why I bring this in is the important thing is because I think this sort of thinking, it's important because at the firm level, at the most basic level, all these five systems exist at once and they relate to outside systems. We can have a coordinated, planned, worldwide economy based upon this. We don't have to have top-down control. We can have this interrelated, sort of like cybernetic control, whereby as long as we have an idea that there is a system in place, that we are working towards definite ends of producing for human needs, we can recursively build upon this model. I think, and it's not, obviously, it's not the most startling revelation in the world. Marx had a similar analysis. There's a bit in Capital where he's talking about Indian villages and how they can just infinitely reproduce themselves because there's these fairly well-known social roles. And if a village gets moved on, the baker gets to baking and the ploughman gets to ploughing, and they can just reproduce the village structure almost as if there was like a seed within any given community to do that. So what we'd be looking at in a social society is replicating some sort of basic organisational plan that just replicates itself upwards and upwards and upwards and down and alongside itself, but that has the capacity at every stage to react, to respond, and to control its own destiny. So that we're talking about from down to the individual, not just to any given organisation, commune, community, or factory, or firm. But the point I want to emphasise in all of this is, and I think I came across it several times, is that politics is absolutely key. That it's relating this back to a democratic community that can make the choice. I said that the various optional models for how we could do things all depend first and foremost upon an agreement about what we want to achieve, and then about picking our agents so that we can say, well, okay, you can enter this market, your job is to relate to the control of this resource, and to agree these things and define the ends to which they need to be put, and to define the agencies which need to carry these things out. So what I've tried to show in a fairly whistle-stop tour is that we have to take on board at least some part of the criticism from the economic calculation problem. And I've tried to illustrate using Sudoku why it is actually a fairly substantial and stern problem that we need to resolve, because we can't just say abundance. We need to say, well, how do we coordinate within abundance? How do we coordinate all these goods so that we don't end up with a Sudoku-style logjam where we have abundance of fives and a shortage of everything else and too many eights as well. And I've tried to show that there are ideas that have come out in the 20th century out of practical attempts in the world, out of theoretical discussions such as cake slicing, and that could be related to this a model of socialism based upon free replicating agencies. And the important thing is the ends to which human ideas are put. Because at the present moment, in capitalism, the best and the brightest, the mathematicians, they're being put nowadays to finding 5 milliseconds improvement on gambling on the stock market. Can they produce a computer system that will do the stock market faster than their rivals? Or actually working for the bookies? Because if you're a maths graduate, you can go to the bookies now and build the computer algorithms that do the in-match betting and that make an awful lot of money. And that's where capitalism is driving our best and brightest ideas. And I think, to come back to William Morris, finally, if the point isn't that, you know, here's a plan for socialism on a plate, it is that we have the imagination and capacity to run a society without money, but at the present moment it is being wasted on making a profit. Thank you.